This is Comics Therapy, episode 56. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, two comics from August 27th, 2014, Cowl number 4 and Mind Management number 25. And on the couch, we have an epic interview with writer Joe Casey. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers ahead.
Comics Therapy. You know the drill. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. This week's theme is one part respect my authority and one part know your enemies. We're looking at two comics where the organizations in power are characters in and of themselves, where the members of said organizations are guided and influenced for better or for worse by their affiliation, where the greater good is wildly up for debate, and where absolute power just might corrupt absolutely. We'd like to believe that super-powered authorities would have our super best interests in mind, but in comics, that's definitely not the case.
Now, usually in between comic segments, we feature your nerd confessions, celebrating what we love and what we snark about comics. But we're going to start mixing things up a bit in that regard. We'll still keep the lines open. You can call, Skype, or email your confessions to us. The details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. I think you know this by now. And yes, catharsis is still cool, but you know what? So is change. So look for that in the coming weeks.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter, at Andrea Schock, and Aaron, at Aaron Myers. The show account is at Comics Therapy. Aaron, I have some stuff that I want to address about last week's DC conversation. So Do you have anything for the good of the order before I switch gears?
Is it you apologizing for stuff?
No, it's me clarifying.
Could you make it an apology?
No, I made an apology publicly already this week. It had nothing to do with DC. And I'm offering a little bit of information about Deadpool as a direct result of some of the shit that you said last week. Not an apology, just a clarification.
I do not appreciate that tone.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Blah, blah, blah. Comics. Lots of them. Blah, blah, blah. Read them. Blah, blah, blah. Same old, same old. Go.
Okay. So here's this week's regression therapy. It's been about a month since we had to do this. So for the record, this segment is a bit of an editor's note, a chance for us to share some of the things that we talked about in between shows. It's not a mea culpa. It's like an opportunity for context. And I want to clarify something specifically about my understanding of the DC multiverse concept going into when Aaron and I recorded last week. There's your context. Any question?
No, so far it sounds good. So far it sounds like you were wrong about something.
I wasn't wrong. I just didn't actually get it.
Okay.
Like, I did not understand the role that multiple universes play in DC.
Okay, well, clarify that for me.
Okay, so, like, Marvel has alternate timelines, and they do have, like, other universes. What I learned this past week is that DC very much prominently exists in this capacity. That we've got, like, multiple stories and multiple Earths, and they are very much part of, like, the DC multiverse in a way that is like embraced differently and more obviously than Marvel.
Really?
Yes.
I don't know. Who's feeding you this information? I don't really see it any different these days between DC and Marvel.
I think that it, for me, the part that like sort of blew my mind is the fact that these are like coexisting alternate universes. Instead of the timelines that, like, Marvel, especially in the current run with Avengers, like, that Marvel sort of dabbles in. I think it's a vocabulary difference.
I guess so. I mean, if anything, the DC multiverse is far more limited in that it, you know, it says there are 52 you know, worlds in the multiverse, whereas Marvel says, yeah, it's infinity. Like, okay. we want a universe that exists because of this reason. Okay, there is that.
But that's a really important distinction that nobody had ever really explained to me. Nobody had ever really put it out on the table that limitation is part of, like, the accepted branding of what DC brings to comics.
Okay, that's fine.
I mean, so that's an important thing to really grasp going into an event and, like, a series like The Multiversity, which we talked about last week, but absolutely demonstrates, like, my complete lack of DC knowledge whatsoever.
Sure, at the same time, it doesn't really matter.
It does. It does matter to me because, like, I like fun things that are fun, and this actually sounds really fun. It was the first time that, like, DC sounded appealing to me because of the way that the information was going to be organized. And honestly, the way that things like Dark Knight fit into the larger DC universe.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I never got that. And I don't mean because I'm an idiot. I just mean that the way that that can actually canonically relate to everything else is there is some logic there. I think I'm giving DC more credit. I think that that's what it comes down to. I'm giving DC more credit than what I had previously understood them to deserve because I didn't get how all of these individual Earths fit together.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, I always found, you know, the idea of the parallel worlds, you know, different dimensions, that sort of thing. It's a great storytelling device to be able to tell the stories you can't tell in your main continuity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, we want Batman to die. Well, we can't kill Batman, but we can kill Batman in Earth 7. So right. Let's tell that story.
And because there is a logic to the way that that is all linked together, and then the overlap with the kind of main storyline also, which is much more embraced with DC.
Mm-hmm.
Than with Marvel. Like, it's like a whole new fucking world, like, quite literally for me. So Rod and I were talking about this, and he's the one who laid it out in a way that I actually understood. And so now I have a bunch of new things to read. And I think the bottom line is that unlike all of the other conversations that we have had about DC, and I don't mean we like you, it's not all your fault, it's like kind of the entire internet, this is the first time that I've been like, oh, fuck yeah, this is cool. Like, I want to know more about how this works. So that's a thing. So I got a bunch of new DC books this past week.
Good. Great.
You should be excited. I'm excited.
I'm excited that you found something about comics that you enjoy.
I enjoy a lot about comics. It's just that I found something about DC comics that I potentially enjoy.
Oh, okay. Yeah, to me, I don't really see much of a distinction in terms of embracing or leveraging parallel worlds between Marvel and DC.
This is why I don't actually listen to what you say about comics.
Well, it's because I'm right. You're just trying to find distinctions to latch onto, which is fine. We all need hope.
It's not because you're right. It's because you don't necessarily listen to me, and so you don't know how to talk to me about comics.
Yeah, I know. It's weird that we do this show every week.
I know. Speaking of which, let me clarify something that you said last week.
Okay.
This comes from Jessica Boyd from Comicosity's The Hangout. She's a rock star. You guys know that. And she sent me a message about Deadpool.
All right.
Since you were all like, ah, there's two Deadpools. Oh, I hate things that are fun. She said...
I don't know if that's a direct quote, but
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, totally. If you can directly quote me incorrectly, I can directly quote you incorrectly.
That was a good sentence. Go ahead.
Shut up. It's really early. An issue of Thunderbolts addresses the fact that there are two Deadpools by having him turn his head and talk to a field or a tree or something, and she thinks that it's Punisher who points out the fact that he seems to be talking to himself and, like, asks him who he's talking to. So while that's, like, a little bit of a nugget of Deadpool lore, I think that that's important to consider, that, like, his characterization has changed and shifted, and sometimes, writers can throw that kind of stuff in to, like, temper people like you who, you know, don't like things that are fun.
It doesn't change how I feel about it.
Dude, nobody is expecting you to change the way that you feel about it. I'm just providing context.
I'm actually surprised either people don't actually listen to the show, or I'm surprised that there wasn't more backlash against last week's show.
There was a lot of backlash about last week's show. Did you pay attention? Mm-hmm. Is it just that you're so fucking full of yourself that you don't care that people were like, what? Aaron's crazy times.
That was like two people.
Really? It was like six or seven people who all thought your disdain for Avengers, like Secret Avengers, was stupid.
I think disdain's the wrong word. I think disgust.
I believe that most people take what we say with a giant plate of grains of salt. But in this particular case, you were out of character in your adamant hatred for this book.
Did I break the fourth wall of our show?
You did. And that's adorable. Look how meta you are. Mm. But I think that it was so kind of outside of what people expect from you that it didn't garner a lot of, back talk from the internet. It kind of just quickly became a joke.
Sure.
So I'm not surprised that you didn't get hate mail over it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like we're not still talking about it.
I don't know.
It's going to be a joke for a while.
I guess. I regret nothing. I feel I'm honest about how I feel. Anyone who doesn't agree with me can still listen.
Nice. You want to talk about comics?
Yeah, let's talk about some comics.
Okay.
Our first book this week is Cowl Number 4, written by Kyle Higgins and Alex Siegel, with art by Rod Reese and Stephanie Perger.
Try again. Stéphane Perger.
Stéphane Perger. It's lettered by Troy Pateri. Cowl is published by Image Comics.
Okay, here's your recap. If you're not caught up, we're in Chicago in 1962. Welcome to the Chicago Organized Workers League, the world's first superhero labor union. With Mayor Richard J. Daley looking to hire non-Cowl heroes, Cowl Chief Jeffrey Warner has led Cowl to strike. Radia, having killed the last of the Chicago Six villains, Skylancer, works with Eclipse in order to take down mob boss Camden Stone. And investigator John Pierce continues to look into a conspiracy involving Cowl-designed weapons. When you bring in politics into the world of superheroes, it really changes the dynamic and makes them much more human.
Yeah, it adds the... Like, it's not... You know, it is a reality of having to live in a world, you know, where you're still a person. It's sort of that Incredibles kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
You know, where it's, sure, you're superheroes and that sort of thing, but if you want to have a family and have kids and, you know, still save the world, there's consequences and there's red tape and you'll have to fill out forms and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, but it definitely, well, I guess what you're describing, like all of that red tape is what rehumanizes them,
mm-hmm.
and then in turn kind of like removes the individual identity. Like, they're not, people still recognize the like the A-list heroes, obviously, but because they're all kind of behind the wall of Cowl, I think that dynamic is really interesting, like especially maybe then for like the D-listers.
Yeah, when you corporatize,
right,
you know, heroics.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah, and you make it a monetary entity, then all the other bureaucracy and corruption and everything else comes along with it.
Right, like arguing with the mayor over, like, the anti-ballistics, the costumes, is sort of a... It's such a, like, petty thing to include in contract negotiations, but really telling about, like, actually financing. Like, what's the bottom line to protecting a city from bad guys?
Well, also, when you have, when, you know, you're talking about a city like Chicago, too, that has a history of corruption,
mm-hmm.
you know, and this sort of political machine throughout, you know, the modern, kind of the modern age, it adds a whole other layer to it of, okay, is it black and white in terms of protection, or, mm-hmm. you know, is it, we'll give you a kickback for this, and these guys get protected a little more than these guys, or maybe you don't go after this crime, and you go after this crime instead.
Yeah, I was surprised as this story has developed, how organized the organization is. And I think part of this comes from, like, we talked to Kyle back in January, right? Way before this book came out.
Yeah.
And so I think I was picturing something a little bit lighter. And this is very entrenched in the, like, pettiness of union negotiations. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way towards unions. I mean that like, a lot of times... That's what gets out at times of, like, contract negotiations with these, like, disparate factions. It's the petty shit. It's the nylon uniform negotiations. It's not, like, the bigger things about, hey, we all have this shared goal of, like, protecting the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's really kind of fascinating to watch how you can take those kind of that real piece of history with Chicago and, like, with politics and with the United States specifically and what it means to be kind of a labor force and look at it at the next level with superheroes as labor It's kind of amazing how typical their struggles are, even though their powers are super.
And you also have this story happening in a time where you have civil rights, and you have sort of this. Like, I think it was the issue before this where it kind of really dealt with that gender equality too.
Mm.
You know,
man, the shit that Catherine gets on all sides, like, both from her coworkers and from, like, just people on the street, and, like, she did, like, a photo shoot for basically, like, a Playboy equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, yeah, I mean, absolutely, she is not perceived as having the same kind of tactical contribution, even though she was the one who was responsible for, like, bringing down the bad guy.
Yeah, she has incredible powers. But because she's a woman,
mm-hmm.
she's relegated to the D-list.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, not necessarily the D-list. It's like the double D-list, right? It's like she's identified as a woman. She's still on the same, like, level of demand as the other A-listers, just in a different capacity.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to talk to her about what she can do with her powers, but they certainly want her around, and they certainly want to talk about her.
Sure. Eye candy.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It makes me wish that I was, like, more savvy with the Mad Men world. I'm sure that there are a lot of parallels, and I just haven't been, you know, watching it.
Mm-hmm.
But because this is very firmly, like, anchored in that time in American history, I'm, you know, I'm sure that it's just like more of the same, like, type of themes that they deal with in that show.
Well, I think that time is brought up a lot these days, because even though we're 50 years past that, I don't know if we've solved a lot of the problems.
I'm going to go with no.
Yeah. So it still pertains to modern times, and it's easier to have those discussions and to kind of integrate, you know, superheroes and superpowers and that sort of thing into it with that lens, even though you could really basically write this story now.
You could. I think that the, like, flagrant disregard for people now are at least, some people are at least more savvy about how open they are with that kind of disgusting, you know,
inequality.
Yeah. That's obviously not always the case. There are so many exceptions that it's, like, really, really depressing.
That's what I'm saying. It would be written maybe slightly differently, but the themes and topics and how it would play out pretty much would hold true.
But what about the organization side of things? Like, unions now have a much more negative connotation.
True.
Even when you're talking about unions of teachers or unions of service workers who provide essential services to communities to like make them safe.
Yeah, any kind of first responders or anything like that.
Right. Like, I think that the general negative, like, association with any kind of, like, organized labor is something that has happened within the past 30 to 40 years as opposed to when this book was set. And in that case, it couldn't happen now. Mm. There's too much cynicism and there's too much tension with that whole system, which came out of a need to protect workers, but is now seen as, I think in a lot of cases, it's seen as like trying to take advantage of the rest of us.
True.
So when you have superpowered unions now, I think that would be too out of the norm.
Yeah, I think these days you wouldn't have it wouldn't be unionized this way. It would be more corporate, you know, corporately controlled.
Sure.
Without representation of the employees.
Mm-hmm. But in a way, we're still talking about an organization as opposed to an individual. It's just the difference between a corporation and a union is that the union is for the individual and the corporation is like for the entity.
Mm-hmm. Well, corporations are people though.
Oh God. If we, that's terrible. If we looked at Cal set now, I think I agree with you. I think we'd be talking about corporations, but I think that the interplay with the individual superheroes and like the quote unquote greater good of the organization would be about the bottom line. Mm-hmm. It would be about like the contract and maximizing revenue. And that's actually a whole separate thing that would be really sort of fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's the union that's the organization in power, ostensibly, they're there to protect the individuals. And so, you know, that was the whole justification for pushing back with the city hiring non-Cowl superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
Is that there's no vetting. There's no relationship then between the union and the individual. Yeah. So, like, I see that point.
For sure. It's taking the whole protection to the next level.
Right.
But it's just an escalation of still what goes on. The same thing happens in the Army now with private contractors. And,
mm-hmm.
Well, you know, there's a lot of correlations to the real world. The trick for a book like this is keeping it interesting, too.
Right.
And, you know, there's a lot of complexity. It's a buildup.
Well, I guess if you're not interested in the people's problems, Aaron Myers, then you're not going to be interested in this book.
I am all about the people.
Are you anti-union?
You know, I believe that America is great because it's for people who pull themselves up by their bootstraps and make a go of it on their own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think unions just inhibit the people's power to get ahead in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And since corporations are people, I think that they should have every opportunity to make themselves better, just like every other American.
I was waiting for the punchline.
All right.
Well done.
Thank you.
That was nicely crafted.
Well, I'm fair and balanced.
Ready for the next one?
Let's talk about our next book. Our second book this week is Mind Management Number 25, written and drawn and everythinged by Matt Kent. Mind Management is published by Dark Horse Comics.
Okay, please note that last month, number 24 was presented as a jumping on point, and I think that that's totally bunk. I accept that not everybody is reading this book, or that some of you might be behind. So just don't listen to this segment. And don't just start with number 24. Go back to the beginning and savor it and love it. Then you can listen to us. But if not, like, skip ahead to Joe Casey. It's an awesome interview. And if you're not up to date on mind management, don't listen. The timestamps are on the site, as always, comicstherapy.com. Here is your recap. Ex-mind management agent Henry Lime was having trouble dealing with his mind-altering abilities. He became paranoid, which resulted in the destruction of Zanzibar. This was promptly covered up by the management, and Lime went into hiding, leaving behind lone survivor Meru Marlu, whom Lime would eventually rescue. Eventually, Lime tracks down Meru and asks her to accompany him in his search to recruit all of the agents he knows. The Perrier twin, the surviving one, Dusty, a Palestinian musician, and Duncan, an agent who can kill with his finger and see 15 minutes into the future. They find Shangri-La, the abandoned headquarters of mind management, and they sort of confront, they band together and confront an ex-agent called Eraser, who is also looking for previous mind management agents. The two opposing factions compete for the new recruits, conflict ensues, and a bunch of people die. Meanwhile, we've got some new agents who have come into the picture that the Eraser has brought together. We've got the Magician, Mute Siamese Twin Assassins, and like a whole bunch of other folks that are hanging out in the Eraser's new hideout, which is looking like the headquarters of the new mind management. The Eraser is building something big, and now no one is left to stop her.
Yeah.
Dun dun dun!
Yep, I like that this book is sort of, this is sort of like a Nautilus in a way.
Oh yeah, that's a great analogy.
You know, we keep circling around similar sort of things, but the circles are widening out and there's the shift and change, but it's still centered around, and it sort of goes back to that organization of superpowers.
Mm-hmm.
And in just a much more kind of insidious way in mind management.
Gee, Aaron, it's almost like I think about the theme when I'm organizing what we're talking about and how we're going to talk about it.
I guess, maybe. I don't know how those things happen. Some things are spontaneous.
Right.
Anyway, can I get back to my thought?
Yeah.
Thank you. What I'm thinking is how is the mind management group inevitable? Like, no matter how many times it would be destroyed, it would always coalesce again.
Okay.
You know, it's this sort of organizational structure of the world.
Well, but here's the deal, because a couple of issues ago, I think it was the one before the, like, the Lime issue. So, I don't know, 22 or 23. When there's kind of a realization that nobody's running the ship.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about an organization like mind management being inevitable, you're not talking about the organization. You're talking about individuals. You're talking about people like the Eraser who have this desire for power and have, or lack the qualms that might be in place to prevent absolute power. And I think that's more inevitable than the organization itself.
So Meru is the will always be, but the organization won't necessarily?
I think that like Meru and the Eraser are like the antithesis of one another.
Okay.
And the organization is the method to the madness. Like nobody's running the ship. It's power by committee. And there's no vision. I mean, that was sort of the problem with mind management, is that there wasn't an ultimate authority. Not that having an ultimate authority solves all the problems, but when you have an organization that's built around the manipulation of superpowers and there isn't a vision, then everything goes to hell.
Okay. But it also, by coalescing and organizing those, it's not going to be a good thing for the Eraser to be in charge.
No, of course not. Absolutely not. But her desire for power comes from her affiliation with the way that power was organized previously with mind management.
Well, it's just how like nature abhors a vacuum, though. She's just filling the space vacated
by the organization.
Yeah, by the disbanding of the organization. Doesn't mean because the organization wasn't run well, doesn't mean it didn't fill a space. And she has just risen again to fill that space.
So do you think, like, in both of these books, we have ubiquitous super-powered people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the powers themselves that are managed, it's the people.
Right. But the people, depending on their abilities, are tools to be used in different capacities.
But, right. So do you think that is that what's inevitable?
That people are destined to be managed?
Yeah, I guess. That it's the people part. It's not the...
Well, it goes back to... I mean, we've talked about this in the past. It goes back to the illusion of choice. That people don't want free will. We just want the illusion of free will.
And tell me again how you classify the difference?
With... Given the ability to do whatever we want. You know, the infinity of possibility laid before us. We become paralyzed and unable to pick anything. If we're given a set number of choices and steered in different directions, we make choices depending on what those limited available paths are given to us, and we feel that we are in control of our destinies.
So Meru's choices were pretty systematically removed.
Mm-hmm. She wasn't given enough choice.
Right. So now she has infinite choices because she has no system or assistance.
She doesn't have infinite choices, though, because she's still being steered down the path of to confrontation. She was set on that path by Lime.
You don't think that she could walk away? I'm not saying that I think that she will.
I mean, we always have
that decision has been removed from her.
Yeah, we always have the ability to step off the path, but that's not how the human mind works. You know, if we go to a job every day, we rarely wake up one day and say, I'm not. I'm going to leave my house, I'm going to get in my car, and I'm going to start driving. Because we're set in patterns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, otherwise, it would be chaos. It's how a species has to function.
Right.
So, it's the same in this book. Like, she is playing out her role as everyone else is. It's just a matter of which way the scales will tip at the end. So, I mean, it's, you know, that could be depressing or comforting.
It sounds pretty depressing when you put it that way.
I guess. I mean, nobody really wants to be confronted.
Anytime you talk about playing a role, anytime you start organizing individuals outside of an organization, it sounds depressing. I'm not saying that the intention isn't positive, but when you're trying to explain to somebody that it's actually in their best interest, that they don't have free will, That's like people are gonna fucking bristle at that.
Sure. Well, that's why you use subliminal messaging and, you know, heavily fattening foods to keep and entertainment to keep you passive and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, but it, in the end, it's humanity doing it to itself. You know, we are who we are because we are the species we are.
That's also depressing, by the way.
Well, sorry, kiddo. There's some good stuff on TV tonight.
Do you think that the Erasers' end goal is to organize the remaining mind management agents?
Those who will come with her.
Right, but like for what purpose?
For the purpose of managing humanity.
Because the difference between Cowl and mind management is visibility.
One is a protection force, the other is a governing system.
But one is well known, and the other exists in the shadows.
Sure, sure. Because it goes back to the nobody wants to know that they're being controlled. Mm-hmm. You know, we fight against that. If we feel that it goes back to the we want the illusion of choice, we don't want to know that our choices are limited. You know, we don't want to know that we are being manipulated. But if we are, you know, we go along with it. I mean, you know, it's like the Matrix kind of thing.
It's like I guess.
Most people, you know, 95% of humanity is content to live in that world. And then the 5% of outliers, you know, they just have to be dealt with. This is a good manual for how humanity needs to be.
Which one? Cowl or mind management?
Mind management.
So, like, less transparent.
Yeah.
Like, you take comfort in the fact that you don't want to know how you're being manipulated.
Oh, I do. I just want to be the one who's doing it. I mean, someone has to be the Eraser.
Oh, you are not. You're just not subtle enough.
Or am I?
Ah! No, for real. Like, which of those, like, big picture ideals is, like, more comforting for you?
Probably as a just a regular person, I would say mind management is more comforting.
Just because then you don't have to be, like, exposed to it on a daily basis?
Yeah, I'm not a person who stands out. You know, it is more comforting to live in a society where you have your needs met. Mm-hmm. You know, where you feel, like, I also come, you know, where you're not marginalized, but you don't necessarily want for much more. It's easy to fit into that because there's other stuff going on. It goes back to the distractions. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I don't really have aspirations for leadership. I don't have aspirations to change the world. I just want to, you know, go to my job, take care of my kids, and read some comic books.
So do you think that Cowl's visibility is part of its downfall? Like, if mind management stood up and said, like, hey, here's the deal. This is what we've been doing for the past umpteen years. Here's the range of powers that we have at our disposal. Don't fucking cross us because clearly we're actually the ones in charge. Thanks, goodbye. Like what happens? That's part of what isn't shared in a story like Cowl is like what happens when the regular folks are exposed to the organizational system that has actually been in control all this time.
Well, but Cowl, the superpowered people aren't in control. They haven't, it's not a coup. It's not that they've taken over society and now, mm-hmm. and now rule the people. They're employees of an organization that are
employed. Now they are.
Right. So if they rise up, then you have a lot of stories like that where, you know, the superpowered people take over the world and then the non-superpowered people have to come together and humanity always triumphs over totalitarianism, which is so an ideal.
Can humanity triumph over mind management?
I think in terms of mind management, it's the the powers and the people in mind management and that segment of society are part of the species. It is part of the organizational organism that is humanity.
That's not really an answer.
So, well, it's like saying, can you rise up over your, you know, your liver? It's like, I guess you can cut your liver out. You're going to die.
Mind management doesn't exist unless they have a group of people to subvert and manipulate.
Mind management is the control system for humanity.
Without humanity, there's nothing to control.
And without mind management, there's no humanity.
Huh. It's really deep, Aaron Myers.
I know. You know what else is really deep?
Our conversation with Joe Casey?
That's true.
Nice segue.
Thank you. You want to talk
to him? This is a great conversation. It's really long, but it's really worth it. It was a fantastic interview, so you are welcome in advance.
Yep. Enjoy. You have no choice but to. Drink and beer in the hot sun. I fought the law and I won. I fought the law and I won. I needed sex and I got mine. I fought the law and I won. I fought the law and I won. A lot of new shit if you got the right friend. Of how this country's run. Think he's all the best friend.
This week on The Couch, we welcome writer Joe Casey. He's written for Marvel, DC, and Dark Horse, among others, and his creator-owned works like Godland, The Bounce, and Sex have been published through Image Comics. His development and production company, Man of Action, created Ben 10 and Generator Rex, both on the Cartoon Network, and produced and story-edited Ultimate Spider-Man and Avengers Assemble on Disney XD. Just recently, he picked up the reins on the new Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers ongoing, published by Dynamite Entertainment. And at the Image Expo that kicked off San Diego Comic-Con, he announced his newest creator-owned book, Valhalla Mad. Woo. Okay. Thank you for taking the time for talking to us, Joe. You sound very busy.
Yeah, from that intro, I think I'm too busy to be doing this interview.
I think so. Thanks for talking to us. We'll catch you later.
All right.
Well, you have a brand new comic coming out, and you have your ongoing series. You have your television work and at least one new title for 2015, like Andrea said. You know, that's a lot. Did we miss anything? We always like to kind of start out with a bit of context so listeners know what to look for. Any new Man of Action projects to share? Any other writing you're doing that you want to let people know about?
Nothing that I can talk about. I think you covered it pretty well.
Okay.
Awesome. So that means I have some basic time management questions for you, like how and maybe a little bit why. I'm curious if you've always thrived on multiple projects, multiple activities, multiple mediums. Like, were you the kind of kid who played three sports and did drama club and volunteered at the local shelter and then also still made time to read? Or is this something that's evolved as you've gotten older to take advantage of both your strengths and the opportunities you've sought after?
I don't know how it reflects on me as a kid. I think it was probably a weird kid. I didn't do any of those things you just listed. I can tell you that.
Awesome. No sports at all?
No, I played sports when I was a kid until I was old enough to realize that I hated it and didn't have to do it. I think that when I first started working as a writer, when you start out in comics, and this was the mid-90s, beginners' page rates were pretty low. So the way that you made a living was through doing more work. You just took on as much work as you possibly could because that made up the difference. Mm-hmm. How little money you were making. And also, it was such a dream of mine to do this for a living. And I had all this kind of pent up energy. And boy, if I ever, you know, break in, I'll be able to do this and do that and do this. And so once I did, it just all this stuff that I had built up was able to come out, and I had a lot of energy. I was just looking for places to put it. So I would take on a lot of work and take on a lot of gigs. And as my career has gone on, that kind of working on multiple projects at once became just a way of life, really. It was a way to do a lot of things at once, keep myself occupied, really. You know, before I turned pro, I was doing things as a hobby. I would work on things in my spare time, and so this, I'm doing the same thing basically, just that everything that I'm doing is actually pointing to some business related result as opposed to just doing it for myself.
Was that like pervasive growing up too, though? Like, do you have that kind of A-type personality that has to be, you have to be doing something, you know, you have to have multiple irons in the fire going or something feels off?
Yes.
Okay.
That's the short answer. Yes, absolutely.
Do you worry, though, about being jack of all trades, master of none, with so many things pulling your attention?
Not really, because everything, it's not about, you know, what I can master. It's about whether or not my voice comes through.
Okay.
And part of that is about craft, but a lot of it is just about how do you make the work that you do personal to yourself?
Right.
How do you make it something that only you could do or only you could do in this way? And the experiment, the social experiment for me is to spread that idea out over all kinds of different things, work for hire gigs, create our own projects, TV, mm-hmm. animation, whatever. The challenge is always the same. Is it going to feel like me? Is it going to sound like me on some level? Is it going to be something that only I could have done? So that's the challenge that keeps going. That never goes away.
Is that then something that you feel like you can evaluate for yourself? Like you can step back and look at your work and you can say, yeah, you know, this was a work for hire thing, but I have my stamp on it. Like that's my voice. Or is that something that you maybe rely on feedback from peers or colleagues or collaborators to tease out while you're working?
No, I never rely on that. it's all in hindsight, to be perfectly honest. That's why I just dive in and do the thing, because I know that it'll be later that I can look back and say, oh, that's what that meant. That's what that was about. That's how it related to my life at the time. I'm trying to close that gap as I, you know, keep going close to 20 years into this thing. I'm trying to close that gap so I'm a little more aware of how the work relates to me as I'm doing it. But I haven't quite closed the gap yet. It's still a little bit after the fact that I look at it and really have the right perspective. And unfortunately, that can come with a regret or two. I should have done this better. I should have been more on top of it there.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of things. But I'd rather take that risk than think that I could just sit there and totally think something out and know going in, oh, this is what it's going to mean to me. This is what it's going to reflect about my personality or what it's going to, how it's going to relate to me in my personal life or whatever. I'd rather just dive in and do it, because I don't want it to be a complete psychological experiment. It's got to be fun too. And part of the fun is to just dive headlong into something and hope you come out the other side. I don't want to lose that, because that's how you start out. You don't really know what it's going to be like until you do it. But that's part of the fun of it. And I don't want to lose that part of it either.
Well, especially since you're collaborating too. So what a project might start out in your head won't not necessarily make it that way onto the page, because you have the vision and the interpretation of the people you're working with as well. I'm projecting, but that seems like that's got to be how it plays out.
Well, that's true. I mean, you're always reacting to what is going on during the process, especially. Everything I do is to some degree collaborative on some level. When it comes to things like TV or TV animation, it's supremely collaborative. So, but with comics, you are definitely reacting to, you know, what did the guy draw or how did the colors look or any part of the process you're reacting to it. And you're either able to react in the moment and adjust, or you just absorb what happened and then take it on to the next thing. You know, everything is sort of a learning experience for the next thing you're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Does that, did you start out having, I kind of have this progression of, you know, as time goes on, but like as a newcomer to the industry, did you feel more rigid in how things needed to be created, especially like your creator owned work? And then did that relax over time?
That's a good question. I think if there was any rigidity, it was, you know, working with editors when you're new and you have to acquiesce to their demands and, or the company's demands or whatever the demands are on you for the particular work that you're doing. When I first started, my breaking in for me meant working at Marvel, working at DC, and working on company-owned characters. So there was a lot of, I had to conform in a lot of ways. And you do that at the beginning, or at least I did, with the goal of, okay, I'm going to do this work. I'm going to acquiesce in certain ways. I'm going to give on certain things. I'm not going to make such a fuss about other things, because if I can just keep working, then I know that I'll build my name up. I'll build my brand up. The momentum will carry me into an area where hopefully I'd be able to do work that I had a lot more control over. And I think that's whenever the artistic meets the commercial, that's always the goal of the artist. How can I take the commercial aspects of what I'm doing and use those to armor myself so that when I really want to stand on principle, on my artistic principles, I have the power to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So early on, I was always thinking, okay, you're still struggling to get your vision out there. Because if it hits, you want to be the one to take credit for it. You don't want to have a big success and all you did was carry out an editorial mandate or a publishing mandate or a corporate mandate. You want to be able to own your successes. So I suppose the struggle in the beginning was to make sure that whatever success or lack of success I had, it was at least on me, as opposed to I saw other guys that were breaking in roughly the same time that I did, and they seemed to be more of the cog in the machine, and that's what they strove to be, or at least it seemed like they strove to be. They wanted to work a lot, so they were willing to acquiesce a little bit more than I was, and they were willing to be more of a company man than I guess I was.
Part of that risk-taking, I think, is evaluating when you can push and when you choose not to. I mean, that risk that you're describing of owning within a company, and I don't mean owning in a property rights kind of way, but just like having ownership over the story that you're telling and your voice in that is a risk in and of itself. But also, like you're saying, the balance with editorial is something that I think is a really important lesson that anybody working within a larger system has to be comfortable with, like when to push and when it's actually okay to not push. And
yeah,
acquiesce sounds like I'm reading too much into the word, but I don't think that's a weakness. I think that it's about balance.
Well, there were times where I was happy to be seen as kind of a get-along guy. You know, I'm a guy that gets along. I don't cause too much trouble. But on the other hand, I was in the trenches, so I was seeing at every moment where something could be kind of whittled away into mediocrity.
Mm-hmm.
On every stage of the game, you know, from my scripts to what the artist was able to do and the time he had to do it, you know, and on down the line. And also, all of my heroes in the business had been pretty big risk takers.
Mm-hmm.
So if I was going to err on one side or the other, it was going to be on the risk side, because everyone that I had gotten into this thing admiring had done the same thing, taking big chances, taking big swings, and sometimes they missed, but at least they took the shot.
Right.
And I was much more interested in that way of doing things than to, you know, what people think at the time gives them some sort of job security. But really, the other thing that I learned is the people that didn't take risks, that didn't really try to put themselves out there or make trouble or be a squeaky wheel or whatever, they didn't last that long. To my eyes, they weren't respected as much by the companies and the editors. And, you know, if you let them roll over you enough times, then that's all they'll see you as a doormat.
Mm-hmm. That's the weakness part, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's there's that part of it too, where you just got to make sure that you're being perceived in the way that you want to be, in the way that's going to further your career, the way that you want it to.
Well, let's talk about a kind of industry stuff and legacy and, you know, people who took risks, I guess, you know, and conform too. Like Captain Victory and Valhalla Mad are both standing firmly in Jack Kirby's legacy. And that's not a secret. You've talked about that and his influence on your storytelling, and it's obvious in these two titles. Do you see it in your other work too? Kind of as a reader, I think it's harder to see it in books like Sex or The Bounce, because stylistically they're very different from anything Kirby might have done. But I'm curious if, aesthetics aside, you still look to him as a model for pacing and rhythm and more of what you do.
Well, not that, because of the projects I've done, that correlation has been maybe over-exaggerated. I'm mm-hmm. a huge Kirby fan, but I feel like everybody who works in superhero comics has that Kirby DNA in them. even if they've never read a Kirby comic, the ones they did read were probably done by guys who read Kirby.
Sure.
And were influenced by Kirby. So there's that part of it. But there's also the real lesson to take from Jack Kirby, from a creative point of view, is to just keep pushing forward. He never repeated himself. He always looked for some new story to tell or some new area of, you know, mythology to explore. He just did not ever rest on his laurels. And you know, people, you know, the general Jack Kirby legend is that he co-created the Marvel Universe, and that's certainly looms large, but people forget he created pretty much the romance comics
that's true.
Genre in the 50s too. I mean, he was a real pioneer all on the way. The Captain Victory thing, he was one of the first big creators to do a direct market only title. So he was there again in his, you know, 60s, still building blocks in the foundation of our industry.
Yeah. And can I ask this is sort of, I'm so far removed from it, and I didn't, you know, I wasn't alive really during like any kind of Kirby heyday, but I feel sometimes the legacy portion of it, it's almost like sainthood at this point, like the Kirby miracles continue to, you know, come out. And there, I think you're right in that, but how much of that goes back to the collaborative process too? You know, like the innovation never seems that I've never witnessed it happening in a vacuum. And as much as he brought to the industry, there's so much that was surrounding him too. You know, do you see that, or am I wrong? Is Kirby the man that, you know, the man, the myth, the legend that we think of him today?
Well, I would say, in my opinion, it's both of those things that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was a part of something larger, but the fact is, for the most part, he just did it better than everybody else at that time.
Uh-huh.
So where, you know, even if it's just command of craft, I guess. And the fact that he produced so much work over his career, you know, it was this instinctual thing. This was a guy that spoke in the language of comics.
Mm-hmm.
And I really admire that. I really look at that as like, wow. I mean, it was such a, not even a second language to him, but more of a first language to communicate with an audience through the comic book art form. And that's, to me, that's probably where he stands alone.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else you could think of had real, you could find their inspirational antecedents. Even Will Eisner, who's a pioneer, was influenced by film noir and, you know, detective movies and all that kind of stuff. You saw it in his work. So you could see where it came from. Jack Kirby was an artist and a creator who really just drew, not even that he had mythology books sitting on his desk. It was just, he had just read these things and absorbed them and spit them back out in this very original way. There's not a lot of precedent for the things that Kirby was doing.
Hmm.
Everyone else, you could find their inspiration sometimes in the work. I mean, you know, you could say, oh, Frank Miller, very inspirational. Well, Frank Miller was inspired by Will Eisner. And then he went on to do Ronin, which was it was Lone Wolf and Cub meets Mobius.
Right.
You know, you see where people came from. Kirby's one of those guys. He just kind of developed over his career very organically, never really borrowed from anyone else. He was a true original. And if his legacy is anything, to me personally, it's that originality. You know, again, it goes back to what we were saying before. It's like, you know, strive to be your own creator, strive to get your voice out there, as opposed to, you know, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody, as opposed to cherry picking the past and experimenting with the medium because you're trying to scratch some nostalgic itch that you had. I've done it millions of times over my career, and other people have too. But that inspiration that Kirby gives us is just to keep pushing yourself to be original, to be your own beast, and to see what comes out of your original brain, not the brain that's accumulated all of your influences. But if you can really dig deep inside of yourself, what can you pull out and put on the page that's going to communicate to somebody else? That's what he did. Even though it was in this very, you know, populist kind of way, that's what he was doing. And that's, you got to push away all of the clutter to get to that kernel of what he was all about. But when you do, when you can, and you can apply it to your own work or your own life or your career or whatever you want to call it, that's where the inspiration really lies.
Well, so let's talk about that with you and how you put yourself into your work, because I think that one of the things that readers find appealing about your work, and like Aaron, I am constantly personally projecting as well, but I think that your characters are often very relatably flawed to the point where the flaws aren't a gimmick. They feel real and they feel authentic. And yes, I know that that's like a really loaded word in fiction, but I think that it's the difference between just enjoying a story versus really having it impact your worldview. So I want to talk about those flaws and those personal demons. You're obviously not writing autobiocomics, but I imagine that you take pieces of your life, of yourself, and you bring them to your characters. Does that come easily to you? Have you gotten more comfortable with it? Is it cathartic as a writer to be able to kind of mine some of those specific parts of yourself to have those more telling experiences for your characters?
I don't know how cathartic it is. I know that it's something that at this point it comes natural in a way. A lot of my comics now, And I've just realized this in a way after the fact, but a lot of them, especially my creator-owned stuff, are these post-experience comics, mm-hmm. which is what happens after an event or a period of time in a character's life. What do you do when a significant event is over, or mm-hmm. you know, however you want to frame it? Because you know, once you get to a certain age and you've had a few experiences in your own life, enough to the point where you're looking back and saying, I had that experience. I'm never going to have it again. I'm past the point where I could have it again. So you're starting to look at things from the other side, as opposed to, you know, when I was a kid or a teenager, even in my early 20s, wanting to, you know, break into comics, just to talk about that. I put so much into the pre-experience point of view, having mm-hmm. not done it, and I wanted to do it, and trying to do it, and trying to break in, and all that kind of stuff. You have this, it's a certain type of energy that you expend to try to make that happen. But it's definitely a pre-experience existence, because you don't know what it's going to be like. You imagine mm-hmm. what it's going to be like. You hope that if and when it does happen, you'll be ready for it. You're preparing yourself for it, but it has not happened yet. The post-experience thing is the very opposite of that, obviously, which is you've had the experience, you've lived the event, whatever it is, and it's over. And now you have to somehow make some sense of it. You have to get some perspective on it, because it's – you feel the need to do that so you can move forward.
Well, there's a weariness and like a sadness inherent to the ending of something, even if it was a good experience. But often what your characters are dealing with aren't necessarily overtly positive experiences or events that have come to an end. So I feel like that perspective is much more mature than the pre-experience, obviously, because stuff has happened, things have changed, and like we sort of have to reconcile that.
Right. I agree. That's the real challenge of adulthood, is to reconcile your past on whatever level you need to do it. And some people never do it. But if you're in a creative industry, or if creating things is what you do, that self-examination kind of comes to dinner, really.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, what are you doing? If it's not personal to you on some level, even the most, you know, pop products that you can come up with, if it doesn't have something to do with who you are as a person, or what you've been through, or how you can speak on the human condition, or whatever, to get really, you know, new agey about it. why else are you doing it? You know, there's enough entertainment out there that's pure entertainment. And I think the reason that people, and listen, I'm not somebody that looks down on something like a popcorn film. You know, I think those roller coaster rides definitely have their place, but there's a reason why in general, there's kind of a slight derision about that kind of entertainment, because you get the sense that there's nothing personal about it.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Even if you can't put your finger on it, you think to yourself, Michael Bay doesn't give a shit about some issue that comes up in a Transformers movie. He's just trying to provide that roller coaster ride.
Mm-hmm.
And that's totally valid. But for me personally, I feel like I need a little bit more meat on the bone. And in fact, if something is really populist and yet still has a personal vibe, that's really the jackpot. That's really what excites you, because then you've got something that's working on two levels. It's working on mm-hmm. the populist level, and it's working on a personal level. And I don't think in pop culture there hasn't been a lot of that since probably, you know, the mid-90s, where the independent film movement of the mid-90s, where you had Tarantino and Paul Thomas Anderson, and these guys that were really trying to put a lot of themselves into their work and be popular at the same time. and find an audience and relate to an audience, a mass audience at the same time. How pop culture kind of has broken apart in these little niches and these little compartments, that's you get that less and less. You know, you get filmmakers who might make a personal film that nobody really sees, and the next thing you know, they're directing a superhero franchise movie. You know, and it's like a different filmmaker. They don't carry with them what they had into the new, you know, into the new context that they're working in. And that happens in comic books too. You know, you know, guys who write on the big franchises for the public, big publishers, they're serving so many masters now that you can't imagine that. I would think that if you're writing a big crossover event for one of the big publishers, the only personal stake that you probably have in it is surviving the experience and coming out the other side with your sanity intact.
Right.
But it doesn't.
So your voice is less about you at that point, and it's more like what you were describing, like cog in the machine, because the machine is so fucking huge.
Yeah. I've been involved in a couple of those over the years. It's certainly a personal victory as a professional to get through those experiences and not want to jump out of a window. You know, you can definitely pat yourself on the back just getting through the goddamn thing.
Is it fun ever?
It can be.
Yeah, okay.
Because it's still ideas, and it's still, you know, I mean, it's kind of fun in the way that when you're talking in the comic book store with a bunch of other fans about just stuff.
Right. Okay.
You know,
playing in somebody else's sandbox for a while.
Yeah. The who's stronger, the Hulk or Thor kind of arguments. Those are fun. You know, you have a good laugh doing those, but at some point, you know, it gets, I mean, if that was all you were doing, I would assume that you wouldn't last very long. You know, I wouldn't anyway.
Yeah. Do you think it's somewhat how the person's creative process works? Because I do feel like in maybe Marvel more than DC these days, there is a lot of creativity and heart in some stories. And maybe it doesn't always go to like the top, the big books, but you know, they crop up, and I don't know if it's in spite of the machine or if it's, maybe, you know, like nature finds a way, like creators have found a way to sneak in the meat into mainstream comics. You know, maybe there's a subtle art to that too, or something.
Well, no, I think Marvel has taken a really major turn in the last year, just in the last year. 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, I would have said, and I did say publicly, I'm sure, while promoting my own work, how stultified I felt like the comics were, and there was sort of like a house style with the art that had been going on for the previous decade. And then they finally turned a corner. I think they had to turn a corner because other people, and generally a lot of it was happening in Image Comics, different art styles were connecting with readerships, art styles that were decidedly different from that Marvel house style that was going on. And the younger editors at Marvel were paying attention and finally, I guess, were finally able to convince, you know, whoever they needed to convince that, hey, let's put, you know, Trad Moore on Ghost Rider, for instance, you know, that never would have happened 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Trad Moore did samples at Cinema Marvel, and they didn't hire him. So that's nice to see. That's very cool to see that the art style at Marvel is becoming more diverse. And now you're seeing it now at DC. I think with those books that they announced, the Batgirl book, the Gotham Academy book.
Yeah.
And That's just you see that the tides change a little bit, that sea change, and it's pretty cool to see.
Well, let's talk about collaboration then. You know, comics are collaborative. Television production is collaborative. Clearly, you play well with others. But you've had a couple of instances recently that took that collaborative process kind of beyond what a lot of writers do. I'm thinking Catalyst Comics and now Captain Victory. You have multiple artists telling pieces of a larger story. Can you walk us through kind of first how much of that came from you on those two projects and a bit of how you manage the writing process and the communication? It seems like you almost have to serve as both writer and director, bringing the parts together. Like, what kind of support do you have from the publishers in those instances too?
Well, I mean, I had enough support to get them done.
Mm-hmm.
And I sold.
That's still the bare minimum, though.
Yeah, it all came from me, to be perfectly honest, because in the case of Catalyst Comics at Dark Horse, again, this was. Probably, I'm like, goddamn, 4 years ago that ball started, and I've never told this to anybody before. This is not public knowledge. But how the Catalyst Comics thing started was originally, and with those same artists that I eventually did the book with, we were going to take on those Gold Key characters.
Oh, that started 4 years ago.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it was going to be. The Gold Key characters were at Dark Horse, you know, before they were at Dynamite.
Uh-huh.
And the books that they had been doing were not connecting with an audience. And if you see the books, it's kind of clear why. I mean, they're totally fine for what they did. But in terms of plugging into some other zeitgeist of an audience that was out there, they just were not doing the job.
Hmm.
So I started talking to Dark Horse about, well, here are these classic superhero characters. Let's really fuck with them. And in the area where at the time Marvel and DC were completely off the boat in terms of using different kinds of artists and getting away from their house styles, it was a lot easier to go to Mike Richardson and say, let's use these artists, because for one thing, doing superheroes when you're not Marvel and DC, you're already it's an uphill battle. They do superheroes better than anybody. They've got all the great characters and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the way you can compete is creatively.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, they were not taking a lot of creative chances. When the New 52 is your big play, you know, you're in the shallow water. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw what was going on through Scuffers. I was able to go to Mike Richards and say, if we use these artists that would never get hired at Marvel and DC right now, and certainly if they were hired, they would be on, you know, sort of novelty stories or one-offs or anthology things. You'd never put, you know, Paul Mayberry on Captain America Monthly, you know, whatever. So I said, well, let's distinguish ourselves by putting these artists, these left of center artists, on these sort of iconic characters. Now, granted, they're not that iconic, but they've been around since the 60s in one form or another. So to me, that classified as they had history, they had some thing to them that if you did them differently, that people would pay attention. And they were sold on it, you know, and we were moving forward to do that. Now, convincing the classic media who really owned the characters, that was a different matter entirely. And eventually, everyone just got fed up with it and just said, you know, Mike Richardson came back to me and said, you know, we've got these characters from this initiative that they did in the early 90s called Comics Greatest World. When in the wake of Image Comics forming, every company had their superhero line,
right?
And Dark Horse had theirs. So we've got all these characters. If you want to take that same aesthetic approach and put it on these characters, then we'll, you know, we could do that. And I said, all right, you know, it's six of one, half does the other. As far as I'm concerned, it was the approach that was the draw for me. It was doing superhero comics differently with different types of art styles. I could have cared less which characters they were. So was able to do that. And then with Captain Victory, when Nick Barucci came to me and said, you want to do Captain Victory? I said, yes, but I want to do it in this same Catalyst Comics kind of way. But I want to push it even farther. I want to get guys that were really left of center. As Marvel was using guys like Tradmore, I wanted to get guys like Ben Mara and Michelle Fife, and, you know, so to take it even one step further out than Marvel was willing to go. Marvel hires Michelle to write all new Ultimates. Would they ever hire him to draw it? Probably not.
Right.
You know, so.
Which issue are his pages in? Is it the third
issue,
one?
No, issue two.
Oh, okay.
Comes out in a couple of weeks.
Right.
So I just feel like that's kind of the fun of it for me. That's part of the game, is how can I stay at least a half step ahead of what I see going on out there. And so now the other reason, a personal reason, was that there's only so many hours in the day. I like all these guys that I'm working with. I think they're fantastic, but there's no way I could get projects happening with all of them. So to find these vehicles where I could get a lot of them together at once. And I get to work with them a little bit, and, you know, we get to hang out, talk comics, and it's that is the fun part of the collaboration. And these guys are a generation after me, most of them. But because of the internet, because of internet culture and having access to all these things all at once, these guys have tapped into influences that I had when I was a kid, when I was a teenager. I just happened to kind of be there for some of them when they were actually happening, as opposed to, you know, researching them on the internet and finding them after the fact.
Right.
But it's still common ground that we share now. So that part has been fantastic, you know, and I think that shows in the work. I thought the first issue of Captain Victory turned out amazingly well.
Yeah, I mean, not to kiss butt or anything like that, but I was a little skeptical of hearing about a relaunch of that. And when after I read it, I'm like, whoa, this, it kind of goes back to that originality, you know, discussion too of, and I think that's even maybe harder when you're working with someone else's character of how do you make it your own. But after reading that first issue, at least in my impression was like this, you know, this is making this character. You have the character and name, but now you've taken ownership of it.
Well, the best thing about Kirby's stuff, his stuff that he created on his own, basically everything post 60s Marvel,
mm-hmm.
is that you don't have to take it at face value. You don't have to look at it as canon. In other words, he did 13 issues of Captain Victory in the early 80s, but I use that as basically a source book as opposed to a Bible.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to cherry pick characters, concepts, ideas, and kind of mix them up a little bit and reconfigure them and tell, hopefully it's a new story, but it's really like, it's kind of like a Kirby remix as opposed to, you know, trying to do something with those characters that maybe they're not built to do. Listen,
or a rehash, maybe.
Yeah. I have a lot of nostalgia for that particular comic. I'm not quite sure if it's the strongest IP you're ever going to run across. You know?
No, I think it's gained traction over the years, though, because it's one of his kind of last, you know, superhero hurrahs.
Right. But I don't necessarily. Well, listen, I'm going to say this and probably be proven wrong in, you know, 5-10 years. But I don't know if I see a Captain Victory movie happening anytime soon. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Which all that means is there's just not a clear cut story there that you can latch on to. And, you know, it's not like, you know, X-Men where you can go, okay, now they're going to do Days of Future Past, or now they're going to do the Dark Phoenix saga or whatever. There's for something like Captain Victory, there's nothing like that. There's only characters and ideas and concepts that you can play with. And so that's what we're doing. We're just having a bit of fun, I guess.
It's not often that you pick up a comic and it's clear that it was fun in production as well as then in product.
Right.
Like, it looks like you guys have fun putting that together. At least, you know, obviously just with the first issue.
Yeah.
And that that translates to like fun when you're reading it. And we talk so seriously about these heavy stories and these like internal conflicts of all of these characters. And oh my God, it's so fucking intense. But like, actually sometimes it's just fun to read comics that are fun.
Absolutely. And I think it's very undervalued that the experience of making the comic can translate to what it feels like when you're reading the comic.
Mm-hmm.
And as certain comics become more and more corporate, that's the big danger, that you're going to lose that. I mean, I haven't done it in a couple of years, so I don't know how fun it is for these, you know, bigger event stories. If it's fun to break them, if it's fun to make them, I don't know. But I don't know if everybody is talking about every time these events happen, which is, you know, I'm not picking on event comics, but they're the easy catch-all for like the quote unquote corporate comic book. You know,
I'm sure.
But they sort of come out and readers kind of are compelled to read them, because if you're interested in the Marvel Universe or the DC Universe, then this is being marketed to you as required reading, you know?
Right. To still be part of the storyline.
Yes. Yeah. Fans don't know, and they shouldn't know, but I mean, when you're in the business, you can't deny it. There are now financial pressures on publishers that necessitate making certain moves or anything. To me, that's why, what I was talking about before with Marvel Comics, how they've started to sort of open up in terms of art styles and artists that they're hiring for major books. You can look at it one of two ways. The optimistic way is saying, wow, they're really opening things up. It's really great. It's diversifying what a Marvel comic can look like and all that. The cynical way is, wow, they saw that other companies' books with different art styles were actually making an impact. So how do we get in on that? Well, let's hire some of those artists. You know.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Now, the truth of it is it's both.
Right.
It's always both. It's never one or the other. It's always both. So you can accept that it's both and either land on the cynical side or land on the optimistic side, and you know, your mileage may vary, but
see, I always see it as like a mutually kind of beneficial parasitic relationship, because you might have people who start out independent get wooed away by a you know, the big two for a while. They establish a name, which allows them then to go back to being, you know, to doing their own independent work.
It's true, except the only problem with that is that we're in a market at the moment where people can actually come out brand new with independent creator-owned work and make a name for themselves, make a living at it, really make an impact. Mm. But when those same creators are compelled, coerced, whatever word you want to use, to go to Marvel and DC and also do books for them, then they are risking a dilution of their brand. Because if you've got a creator X and he's working on a creator-owned book at Image and a corporate IP superhero comic for Marvel or DC, there's enough just typical superhero fans that are buying that superhero work that mask the popularity of creator X. But the companies go, well, here's a resource. And also they're getting them cheap because they're new.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's use them more. And you know, believe me, there's more politics involved than you would think. And not necessarily on sort of like, it's not a corporate mandate. It's certain editors have certain way of looking at things. And if I can tie up this creator on, you know, so many books at Marvel, then he won't have time to do his creator-owned comic, and we'll have him all to ourselves, and whatever fan base he has will always come to him at Marvel, as opposed to splitting his audience up. You know, people go to his creator-owned work or people go to his Marvel work. There, believe me, it's that kind of thinking does occur, And I'm not even saying that's a bad thing. That's, again, that's part of the Gordon Gekko of it all. You know, it's about, they are shark infested waters and it's sink or swim. And part of the game is whether or not you can maneuver those waters, you know? I bring that up not as a way, not to disparage it. It is the system, but as a creator, you have to be aware of that system and again, pick your path. What is the path that you want to take? Because unlike any other time in the history of the industry, creators are able to pick their path and make it work for them. It's amazing that we've finally gotten to this point, but it's here, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, I was really down there for a minute because, like, I was feeling sort of sad about the politics stuff, and I was going to throw you a music question to, like, build us up and be positive again. And then you turned it around, and you made me feel like, okay, everything isn't terrible. But now I still want to ask about music.
Okay.
Because I know that it's a pretty important part of your non-comics life. You've played in a band for years, right?
Yes, many bands.
What do you play?
Guitar.
So is music part of your comics life also? Like, do you listen while you're writing?
Sometimes, but not...
I want the answer to be yes, because then I want to know, like, how it changes depending on what you're working on.
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint.
Oh, come on.
I've used it for inspiration sometimes when, you know, because when you're doing this thing and you have to produce, and you feel maybe the well is dry, you'll go anywhere to kickstart the inspiration, kickstart your feeling about what you're doing.
Okay.
And it's
so, like, the emotional response is what you're tapping into?
Sometimes. I mean, I'm just tricking myself into being inspired because of a particular era of music or an era of music history or whatever it is. You know, I'll shamelessly manipulate my own brain into feeling like charged up about something. And then I can use that in my work to some degree.
Well, you asked if you could pick the music for this episode, which is awesome. Have you, and just for anybody playing along at home, like, I just told Joe the theme, Respect My Authority, this morning. So it's, like, patently unfair that I'm putting him on the spot now. But I'm curious if you've given it any thought. Or if we're going to get surprised with them later.
You'll get surprised with them later. I mean, mainly I was thrown because the one thing I'm very bad at is respecting authority. So I have to think about it for a while.
It had less to do with you than the other books that we're going to be talking about later in the week.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. Listen, I accept the challenge. Don't get me wrong. I accept the challenge.
And music can reflect the antithesis of the theme, too. So
that's true. Yeah. That's absolutely true.
That's good to know.
Well, in along that vein, let's talk about kind of like the other life stuff. I imagine, you know, downtime is really important to you, and by the same token, your personal privacy is as well. So yeah. We, you know, we talk to so many creators about the role of social media and promoting and sharing their work, and you seem to shy away from that. On one hand, it's a huge time suck, so it makes a lot of sense that you literally wouldn't want to prioritize your hours in the day to include Twitter or Facebook or, you know, whatever. But yeah. Do you feel more separated from your readers because of that? Does it make experiences at cons more important? Or is that personal connection with your audience less directly tied to the creative process?
I suppose that the way I look at it now, aside from the time suck factor, which is huge, is that I do the best that I can to make the work itself personal enough that if you're reading it, then you are getting a sense of what I'm about to some degree. And I also tend, in my creator-owned books, I tend to put a lot of, you know, backup material and where I spout off and pontificate about God knows what. So there, that's kind of my form of, you know, the Facebook blog posts. But I don't really, I guess there's enough instantaneous delivery of people's random thoughts that I feel like I don't really want to contribute to that white noise if I can help it. Mm-hmm. And that's not to put anybody else down. It's just me personally. I'm just old enough, God help me, that doing that is not a part of my kind of psychological makeup. And so I would have to force myself to do it if I was going to do it. And I mean, really force myself. And probably in forcing yourself to do it, you just end up just spouting a lot of bullshit. And you know, why bother if it's just more bullshit? Why, you know, there's enough bullshit out there that I can see that to contribute to it. I don't know if I could live with myself. You know? if I felt like I was the kind of person that had something interesting to say 24 hours a day, then maybe it would be, you know, something I'd be more into. But I don't feel that way about myself. I don't feel like I'm particularly interesting at any given moment. And I feel like the craft of creating something is a part of it is about self-editing and about measuring the amount of stuff that you put out there and having some control over it. And my view of social media is that it breaks down some barriers between yourself and the rest of the world in the sense that you can just vomit out whatever random thoughts you have, whether it's on Twitter or on Facebook, where you can kind of do longer pieces or whatever it is, or Instagram, where you can try to show the world what your eyes are seeing all the time. You know, here's the, you know, here's my dinner, you know, click, you know, and you put that up or whatever. I don't know. I value my own point of view as being my own, enough to like, to understand that I'm probably the only one that's interested. So I'm not going to force that upon the world. And also, it's also a thing of, you know, okay, so I'm going to start a Twitter account tomorrow, right? Now I have to spend, and this is, goes back to the time suck thing, but only tangentially. There is the time suckage of, okay, what do I got to get followers now? Do I have to now tweet things that somehow get people to pay attention? So then later when I, you know, promote my work, there's an audience and I'm promoting it too. It just seems like there's enough opportunity for rejection in my career as it is. You know, putting out comics and putting out, you know, TV and just product in general that people can either embrace or reject. But I don't need it on the personal level. I don't need to think that, oh my God, I'm being rejected, you know, on this. It's not my work that's being rejected. It's actually me that's being rejected.
Yeah.
I've never heard
anybody say it quite like that, but it makes a lot of sense, especially given how much of yourself you're talking about putting into your work. So,
well, but here's the other side of it. That's the side of it that's, you know, the pathetic side. But the side of it that's actually more positive is that I also, at this point in my life, don't need the validation that, you know, having 10,000 followers gives you, if it gives you any at all. I don't know if it does or not. I don't need to find out. You know, I don't need the thumbs up like on my, you know, Facebook post, you know, or my YouTube video to validate my existence or to make me feel good about myself.
But there's a monetary aspect to it too, though. I mean, at least, and maybe not for somebody who's established as yourself, but when it goes back to those, you know, the younger creators, I can see having a social media presence gives you awareness that you maybe, that takes a lot longer to build up otherwise, especially in, you know, in society the way it is now.
I totally agree. And for them, it's great. I actually feel lucky that I am just the generation right before that, all that stuff happened, where I had to, you know, I had to do it the old fashioned way through internet interviews and Wizard magazine. but it actually, it actually served me well, because it kind of gave me a little more control over how I built my brand up over the years. And so I was very prepared when Twitter and Facebook and MySpace and all that stuff sort of came out, that I didn't need it. I didn't need it. I was already out there. I was already, my career had already been somewhat established. So to not need something, it's very liberating. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Okay. I have one last big question before we wrap up about Man of Action, specifically because you guys do really fantastic family-friendly animation work. And you've gone on the record discussing how shows like Ultimate Spider-Man are reaching the kids who aren't reading comics, because there hasn't been the same kind of resurgence in readership with kids now that happened in the early 90s when, like, Aaron and I were kids.
That's right.
There's lots of reasons for this, and like, we talk about it a lot on the show. Do you think that Marvel and DC should be, and I'm calling them out specifically just because of the iconic nature of the characters and the, I guess, kind of brand recognition. Do you think that they should be doing more in comics specifically to woo those younger readers? Or are you comfortable with the primary access point for kids being cartoons first and then hoping that they find the comics later as they hit the target age that most of the traditional superhero comics are being written for?
That's a good question. The only thing I know is that when I was 7 years old, I was reading the same comic books that, you know, teenagers were reading and guys in their 20s were reading. The people that were making those comics were not differentiating between kid readers and adult readers. They were just trying to make good comics that everybody could like.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, in, you know, a typical Marvel comic in 1977 or 78 was not going to have nudity or cursing or any of that other stuff. The medium itself and the characters necessitated a certain age range of readership. I don't think that, you know, Chris Claremont, to just pick a name out of a hat, but he was the big dog in like 1979, like X-Men. I don't think that Chris Claremont, or even Frank Miller when he was doing Daredevil, I don't think they were under any illusions that their audience was anyone outside of a general kid audience. You know, it's kind of like, this is a hard question because how old are you guys?
I'm 35 and my son is 9. So I have my personal experience as a kid growing up in like the 80s and early 90s reading. And then I have kind of my desire for my son's experience to be at least something that I can relate to as a young kid being into comics.
Right.
And I'm basically in the same boat. I'm 36 and my youngest is 4, or my oldest is 4. I mean, I have a 1.5-year-old.
So you guys were, am I assuming that the first comic books, if you guys read comics as a kid, were you guys there for the first wave of Image Comics?
Yeah, yes. That is my bread and butter.
Okay. You guys are the last generation of kids who read comics, in my opinion. Based on all the evidence I've seen, you guys are the last ones. That group of artists and creators were the last ones who, for whatever reason, and it's basically because of their age at the time, they were writing and drawing material that was targeted not specifically, but let's face it, the level of sophistication that those guys were capable of,
right,
was only going to appeal to young kids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when I was 13, 14, 15, that was like the greatest comics I could ever have imagined.
Exactly. Exactly. They were perfect for that your generation.
Mm-hmm.
we've never had another big wave of talent or books that ever captured that audience again. Now, a lot has to do with, you know, the rise in other media and all that stuff. That's perfectly valid. But the fact is, the material after that post-image boom, kids' comics became a different thing. They became, you know, the DC adventure stuff or the Marvel adventure stuff, or these kind of really watered down, you know, crappy books,
right,
that no kid would ever be caught dead reading. Because if you have, you know, Bruce Timm inspired version of Batman on one comic, and you have the Kelly Jones, you know, dark and twisted Batman on another comic, which one is a kid going to want to go for?
It's true.
You know, which one is more compelling on levels that you can't even articulate when you're a kid, but you just know one thing is cool, another thing maybe isn't so cool. Mm-hmm. Especially then when you start to read the stories and you think one story is a little bit beyond my ability to understand and comprehend. One is like something for a 3-year-old.
Yeah.
Right. You know? The difference between kids and all ages, it's like we talk about it semantically all the time and sort of rue the fact that there's not a better conversation beyond vocabulary. But there really is a huge difference between, especially now that my son is creeping up there towards the age that I was when I started reading, the things that he can pick up on now, just in the past year, so, so different. And he's ready for something that's more sophisticated, and there's just not a lot out there.
Well, those you know, quote unquote, all ages comics, to me, they don't have any shelf life at all. I mean, if you're 12 years old in 1980 and you're reading, you know, the death of Phoenix,
mm-hmm.
you're blown away by the drama and the emotion and the craft on the page. It's just a good comic. But mm-hmm. for my money, when you're, you know, 20 years old, you can then go back to that comic and look at it and appreciate it for a different reason. There's still a level of craft there that holds up. There's still a lot of value to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But all ages or kids comics, they're not being made with that same level of lasting care.
Oh, so you're not making a distinction between those two. So I was saying kids comics are the ones that don't have the shelf life, like how you describe, but the ones that are can appeal at multiple levels to that kid when he or she is 12 and that adult reader, is that's the kind of stuff that I wish there was more available. Like, that's what I want Avi to be able to read so that I know that he can handle it, but then it doesn't feel like it was written for 3-year-olds.
Yeah. I think, yeah, I mean, you know, modern...
It's hard. It's a weird point right now in terms of the way that a lot of the... And again, I'm talking about the iconic Marvel and DC characters, because that's what they see around them. Like, those are the movies and the
cartoons. Those guys that were making the comics in the 70s and the 80s at Marvel and DC, they were just one step removed from the Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Marvel 60s, that they had enough of that in their DNA to be able to deliver on that at that level. But they had enough of a growing sophistication in their own tastes and in the and using the culture around them to move the content forward just a little bit, just a smidge, just enough to give it some air of sophistication. But I think that a guy like Chris Claremont in 1980 or Frank Miller, they were aware that there were kids reading the comics. So they were made sure that even if they were trying to satisfy their own creative urges and plug into their own inspirations, whether it's Will Eisner or whatever the hell Chris Claremont is reading science fiction wise, they were serving two masters, themselves and their audience.
Mm-hmm.
Creators now only have to serve themselves, because the audience is pretty much their age. It's one of the reasons why I'm perfectly comfortable writing a book like Sex every month, because I realized that the audience, the majority of the audience that's out there that would buy it are probably in my age range. So
sure.
Why do I have to worry about any kind of age appropriate material when no kid would ever pick up that comic that I'm making? Now, if I was at Marvel or DC and I was writing, you know, Captain America or Green Lantern or whatever, I would hope that I would keep that other audience in mind. The problem is that audience doesn't exist. There's not enough of them out there to justify, you know, not just following your own, you know, 40-year-old muse and like, well, what does a 40-year-old think is interesting? You know, well,
it's so weird to me though, because like that's our audience, like that's us, right? You just said like we're the last group of kids, and so now we're growing up and we have kids, and like, shouldn't that be kind of the obvious next kid audience is our kids?
Well, the problem too is that, you know, comics are a business and the big publishers have to stay in business. What normally used to happen, every generation would read, you know, Marvel or superhero comics when they were a kid, and then in their teens they would hit puberty and they would give them up and they would move on to some other thing. And the next generation of kids would come in and they would start reading Spider-Man or Superman or whatever. And then they'd have their roughly 5 to 7 years of reading comics. And then they'd move on, which is why the comics would sort of, you'd see that cycle. If you look at the history of like a long running title like Spider-Man, you'd see those. And I'm not talking about what they do now, these sort of editorially mandated reboots. You'd see these sort of soft resets because they knew that, you know, a new generation, a new group of kids were just now finding the comics and getting into the comics or, you know, whatever. And but at some point that stopped happening. And probably in the mid to late 80s, just as you guys were just getting into it, it just kept going. It never started to recycle. And when it did recycle, it was, you know, Spider-Man making a deal with the devil so he's not married anymore. Some weird editorial story mandate that a 40-year-old can accept, as opposed to just a kind of a soft, like, here's a restating of everything that Spider-Man's all about. So that if you're, you know, 10 years old and you're picking up the comics for the first time, you can get into it here, you know?
Right.
That doesn't happen anymore at all with these big superhero characters, these big iconic IPs that are at the two big companies. Now, it might be too far gone, because what's going to happen now, think about it. This is true of my generation, certainly true of your generation. If you think about characters like Bugs Bunny, Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, you don't think of, you know, they're cartoon characters. You know, they came from cartoons, but your perception of them is so merchandised, it's all bed sheets and lunchboxes and commercials. You know, they're pitchmen now. That's what these Marvel and DC superheroes are eventually going to be, because, you know, your kids, their awareness of Marvel and DC characters are probably from sleeping bags, cartoons, commercials, toys. You know, when I was a kid, the only place you could get Iron Man was from an Iron Man comic book. Mm-hmm. And maybe an occasional cartoon every once in a while.
So it's less about the mythology at this point, and it's just more about the commercial image.
They're IPs. They're not mythologies anymore. They're not stories anymore. They're IPs that need to be maintained. And you can kind of mask it in like, okay, now Tony Stark is drinking again. Or, you know, we know Spider-Man's secret identity is public again. But it's, you know, that's just a way that corporations make sure that they hit a certain sales quota every year, so that their stock, you know, their stockholders are happy, and that they're not, that the line on their profit graphs are not trending downward. That's all. There's even a flat line can get you into trouble these days. If your profits have maintained a steady pace across 4 or 5 years, someone's going to look at that and go, why isn't that line going up? you know,
yeah.
And you have the pressure to deliver, you know, I mean, the pressure on a guy like Axel Alonso, who's a great guy, is probably enormous, you know, guys who came out, and Axel's older than me, so he comes out of that. He knows, he remembers when comics were really creatively driven and they were a little tinier business that didn't have all these financial pressures. Can you imagine that's your background, but now you're thrust into a situation where you have movie studios that are, you know, that the synergy with them and stockholders and, you know, all this stuff. I mean, it's unbelievable that those guys do what they do every day. You know, I'm certainly not going to sit here and bash them for the content of their product. I can sit here and bemoan the state of pop culture and how comics relate to it. But I know that everybody who works in this business has enormous mountains to climb every day. And the guys that are my age and older who work in this business are either they're embracing the new economic models to the detriment of their own belief systems, perhaps, which is kind of soul crushing in its own way. And God help those people, because they may end up in hell just for, you know, just out of betrayal of their own idea systems, you know, their own belief systems.
Oh, no. But,
or they're just fucking trying to make their way in a world. They're like Howard the Duck. They're trapped in a world that they never made and don't understand, you know.
Do you still do it because you love it, though?
Me? Absolutely. And look, I even love this whole part of it, because being one step removed, I'm not a businessman. I'm a creative guy. So I can interpret the business and try to understand it and have a laugh at its expense. Mm-hmm. Because I know I'm never going to be a businessman at that level. But I think that sort of as a sort of anthropologist of this industry, I love talking about this stuff. I think it's fucking fascinating where we've ended up, you know. I'm taken care of creatively. I do my stuff at Image Comics. They let me do what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not struggling to get my shit out in the world.
Right.
So that's not a concern for me. So then I have the luxury of being able to look at the bigger picture and pick it apart and have a good laugh at its expense, or feel sad sometimes, or feel like, oh my God, how did we get here? Or how can we, you know, maybe steer the ship in a different direction? You know, it's all fun. I mean, it's not a laugh riot, but it's still fun.
I guess that's good. That's good. It, just like before, you know, you made me a little worried. There's a little cynicism creeping in there, but it's fucking real. It's honest.
I welcome the challenge of battling my own cynicism. That's part of it. You know, I know it's there and I know it exists and there's good reason for it to exist.
Sure.
So it's like, I'm Don Quixote and that cynicism is my windmill. I'll fight it till my dying day, you know, but I'm not going to ignore it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to pretend that it's not there, because you have to be informed. You have to know what it is you're fighting against.
Yeah.
If you're going to make any progress at all, you can't be naive. You can't put blinders on. You just got to keep pushing forward and saying, all right, this is the state of the world right now. And I'm going to fucking attack it like a rabid dog.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Joe. This was, holy shit, man. This was fantastic. Thank you so much for talking with us on the couch this week.
What a great Sunday conversation.
Right.
I think so.
Man. Thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop and subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on our site, as always, comicstherapy.com. We will see you next week.